Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 4th of December. I'm Joe Donahue. In this hour, we'll start off with our open discussion of issues. It's our roundtable panel joining us. WAMC's Alan Shartok, Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo, Ray Graff will be here, and bureau chief of the Capitol, New York, Jimmy Bielkind will join us. Later in the program, we will meet war correspondent Paul Conroy. Andrew Solomon will tell us about being far from the tree. We'll hear from the Rosendale Theater production of It's a Wonderful Life, and author James Kennelly will tell us about the Irish Edge, plus Alan will be in the Congressional Corner with Bernie Sanders. We have lots to talk about. Join us. The Roundtable begins after news. We always love to hear from you. Roundtable at WAMC.org.
But, you know, keep it brief. A paragraph is good. We don't need 12 pages. We don't have time. Just slam us in one paragraph, and then we're all happy.
There you go.
I like the smart ones that go on and on and on, but you're right. If they're going to just say you're idiots, you're stupid, you don't know anything, that can be said in just a few lines, really.
Well, say on the...
It's much tougher to refute if it's brief, too. No, you're right. We are idiots.
On Vox Pop, I often say, when it's come around for the third time, you know, you're done.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. And there's sort of a fine line between a comment and a manifesto. I've noticed. Anyway.
But well, that said, we really do want to hear from
yes. you. Yes. You know, join the discussion.
Marx was both a comment, communist commentator, and wrote a manifesto.
The comedy, right.
Yes.
That's right.
You see that?
I see what
it didn't work.
No, not quite. Right. Not,
it sounded like you were stuttering rather than making a pun.
Right.
Yeah, and when you start to, if you use a phony stutter, you're going to hear from somebody.
Right, and so if you're going to complain about that, one paragraph or less, Alan at WAMC.org.
Okay, next topic.
Joseph did write in and was very brief, said subverting the Michigan Constitution and equating promises to workers and instead favoring bondholders is a clear indicator of the governing elite's bias to the wealthy over the working citizens whose contracts are rendered moot.
And it's a perfectly good, Joseph makes a perfectly good example of what choices there are to be made.
But the judge clearly said that he does not see the Constitution that way. There's nothing in it
Well, why do you think they made him a judge?
Forever. Yeah, so he gets to make the call, not Joe or us.
Well, the unions have appealed instantly, so right. this will play out.
It will.
Oh yes, and the 5-4 group on the Supreme Court are certainly going to say, Judge, you were wrong.
Supreme Court's not going to reverse this.
Right.
Yeah, that's my prediction.
And in our 15th viewing of the movie Groundhog Day, let us read this story, where more than a year after the Supreme Court upheld the central provision of President Obama's health care overhaul, fresh wave of legal challenges to the law is playing out in courtrooms as conservative critics, joined by the Republican allies on Capitol Hill, make the case that President Obama has overstepped his authority in applying it. A federal judge in the District of Columbia will hear oral arguments on Tuesday in one of several cases brought by states including Indiana and Oklahoma, along with business owners and individual consumers who say that the law does not grant the Internal Revenue Service authority to provide tax credits and subsidies to people who buy insurance through the federal exchange. At the same time, the House Judiciary Committee will convene a hearing to examine whether Mr. Obama is, quote, rewriting his own law by using his executive powers to alter it or delay certain provisions. The panel also will examine the legal theory behind the subsidy cases that the IRS and, by extension, Mr. Obama ignored the will of Congress, which explicitly allowed tax credits and subsidies only for those buying coverage through state exchanges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the party, remind me, that doesn't believe in judicial activism, right? I can remember growing up listening to stuff being done by William Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, thinking how wonderful it was that they were using the law to promote justice and their cause. And what we're seeing now is the conservatives are doing the same thing.
But
of course, the system's open, but that's what they're doing. They are going to stop. Well, they can't change it legislative, so they've switched to the judiciary.
But, I mean, lawsuits are
trying to change it.
Lawsuits are the way – I mean, they're not engaging in judicial activism. I mean, they're bringing a suit. A judge would do that.
Well, yes, but they're asking for the judge to be a judicial activist in a conservative sense.
But suits are brought all the time. We'll see how it's decided.
Yeah, I get mine at Gentleman's Warehouse.
Really? You're going to like the way you look and whatnot?
Oh, boy. Okay, I can't keep this serious. I'm really trying, folks. So, yeah.
Okay, but Ray, I think the fact that the Supreme Court has spoken on the court, we are seeing some already coming through. And basically what they're saying is leave it alone. Leave it alone. You know, the law is law. And
the Supreme Court ruling that held up the law in basic still took a little snipe at it. And they took out the whole state having to, you know, increase Medicare. So I don't know that that's true. I can see them saying, okay, yeah, we'll take a little bite out of it here.
I don't think so, because they're afraid that they'll ruin the whole thing. And they don't want to do that. That's the stability of the government, and I don't think they want to do that. That's what I think the Roberts ruling was all about when he stepped forward. And I think the fact that they put it on the table, and there have been some that they already have that are already coming through, which are showing that what I'm saying is so.
We'll see. I think this is another campaign. And I use the broader term of using the judicial system to get what you want. Just like going after Roe v. Wade, it could not be stopped legislatively. Right. And so you saw the action taken back into the state courts. And abortion has been much stymied in this country because of that. And I think that's the same thing that we're seeing with health care.
We'll see.
I just want to quote the Attorney General of the state of Oklahoma, Scott Pruitt, who is bringing one of the cases forward on Monday. And he said, the president himself has said on more than one occasion, I can't wait on Congress and our system of government. He has to.
That seems to me like something the court would agree with.
Anyone would agree with, right?
Joe is so smart. Because I began to hum Oklahoma, but only to have two bars, and he got it right away.
Yeah, you're a little out of control.
I can name that tune in one note today. So where does this – because it seems that when you have these fights burbling, and then you have the system trying to get up and running, and we have this whole debate over whether the number of people who are insured – and are getting enrolled in the system, doesn't this all have an effect? I don't know how it cannot have an effect.
You mean holding people back because they don't believe in the system? It undermines the system.
Well, it undermines the system, and you wonder, well, you know, am I going to get enrolled in this thing, and then they're going to turn around and repeal it at some point?
Yeah, no, I think you make a very good point.
Yep. Yeah, and we don't know the numbers. I mean, there are lots being thrown around that either 40 or 47 million, we've used both on this program, will eventually be enrolled. But right now, so far, 100,000 have signed up. That's a big difference
listen to NPR, they're getting the troops out. There are going to be people walking around the neighborhood signing people up, just like they do with voter registration.
I think it's a lot like buying new technology. It's like, I really want one of those, but I'm going to wait a while until they get the bugs out and everything's working and, you know, they're going to change the law so I won't get in trouble anymore. I'm going to just wait.
But if they change the law, it's not going to be fast. I mean, if you repeal a law...
No, I mean, change the penalties, right? If you don't meet the deadline...
Well, the real question
is coming up.
Whether they'll enforce the deadline. Whether they'll enforce the fines.
I think
and
that will be
that
hard.
There are people in this country who just follow the law. Law says you do it, you do it. And there are people in this country who always love to test.
Well, the president's testing, too. He keeps delaying portions of it and changing, throwing back the small business aspect of it by a year. So it seems to be fairly...
I don't think he's testing it. I think he did it because he had to, different than testing it.
But what I'm saying is if no one really knows...
Responding instead of testing.
What is going to be there and when it's going to be actually the law that you have to do it... Then what kind of a law? It's a law or it's not a law? Or it's not in place?
That's the interesting question at the heart of these lawsuits that we're talking about, is that saying a law is a law, the legislature makes it, and we're supposed to enforce it. What are you doing here?
Yeah.
My answer is the Volstead Act. In other words, if something really doesn't work, you repeal it. I don't think that's going to happen here. I think this is going to be a huge part of what America does and what it's known for.
So in we only have a minute before we have to go to break, but the president leaves on the road to go on the road today.
Yeah.
And part of his message is that the Affordable Care Act fits into his vision for Americans' economic security and upward mobility. Is it a smart move to say that something as so troubled is going to be our panacea of improving the economy of this country.
He doesn't want to play defense anymore. He's on the offense. He's going to go out there, and he's going to make the argument that it's good, that it works, that everybody should sign up for it, and he's not going to be defensive, and he is finally saying exactly the right thing, which is, okay, there may be some foul-ups, but when that happens, we'll deal with the foul-ups. And that was our big mistake in the beginning, and he said that. Our big mistake in the beginning is we said that this is going to work perfectly, and it doesn't. Nothing new ever works perfectly.
Mm-hmm. And on those words, we will close out this section. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to go to an NPR news break. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Jimmy Vielkind will join us, Bureau Chief of Capital New York. Ray, thank you for being with us for the first half hour. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you. We'll be
marginally.
We welcome your we welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC. I kind of wish we had Oklahoma now. WAMC.org, and we'll be back after this short break. Welcome back to our roundtable panel. We welcome your comments. We'll get to them in just a moment. Joining us on our panel this morning at WAMC's Alan Chartok, Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter, Rosemary Romeo. I realize that why I pause there is because it is it's university at Albany, and I'm just saying Albany journalism professor.
That's fine.
And that's why it sounded weird to me, and that was why I was pausing. And
I
now I've realized what my faux pas.
And whatever happened to SUNY? I still like that better.
Well, they yell at you if you say that.
I know.
If you say SUNY Albany, you get emails and letters and cease and desist orders.
They want to change their ID.
State Teachers College at Albany.
Yeah.
Original name.
Bad stuff. And we welcome to the conversation the he's bureau chief. It's Capital New York.
Ubiquitous.
And which is Capital New York.
Within AL.com.
Capital New York, AL.com. And Jimmy Vielkind joins us. And we'll get to some state stuff in just a moment. Let us go to the letters. We've got a lot on Detroit. James writes, Detroit had to be permitted to file bankruptcy before it could reduce government pensions. This, according to the Michigan Constitution, it is true. Is that true in New York State? Asks James. Would New York State first have to file for bankruptcy before the New York State employee pensions were reduced? Your listeners might want to know. I do not know the answer offhand. Do you?
Yeah, I think that generally, and there is no real precedent for bankruptcy in New York State. And that's something that came up a lot this past legislative session. It's probably going to come up again in this coming legislative session as municipalities become increasingly squeezed. But in New York, we generally don't declare bankruptcy. Of course, a bankruptcy allows your contracts to be blown open, and that would include pension contracts, which are essentially contracts with public employees.
Mm-hmm. So. Rich writes and says, I feel we will continue to see the things happening with pensions in Detroit, a former industrial powerhouse, and other cities. As more jobs are lost in this country, this will only get worse as quote-unquote free trade agreements such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership allow companies to go offshore and bring more jobs to low-wage countries. This further erodes the tax base nationwide, resulting in self-defeating cuts in education and other essential programs.
Good letter.
Also, Christine writes in response to comments just read on the air by Kevin, the judge did not favor bondholders. He held that pensions are contracts that, like other contracts, are subject to adjustment in bankruptcy. Yep. Bondholder contracts may well be subject to adjustment, too. These are tough issues, and the judge was incredibly thoughtful. Whether we think he is right or wrong in the law, and I fear he is right, there are no easy answers.
Very good letter.
No comment.
Tony writes, the worker who decides to take a dollar less of current income does so because he expects a future benefit that has a discounted present value of more than a dollar to him. Usually workers expect that the employer would keep its promise when the employer is his own government.
Good letter.
If the promise is only half kept, then the worker's original decision to take a pension benefit in exchange for lower wages is cheated, but he is being cheated in the same way that bondholders are cheated when a city that declares bankruptcy and pays the bondholder only half.
Another good letter.
Barry writes, at 62, I see many revered institutions falling away in this country. Pensions are one. Everything we once thought would always be here are going away. Service at gas stations, free air for our tires. And now I have to take care of my family graves because the cemeteries lost all their money invested in perpetual care during the Great Recession. It seems impossible, but has happened. So we have to find solutions instead of trying to reverse what no longer can be.
And Barry, they tell us that change is good.
Free air still at Stewart's.
Yes, that's true. Although they have those new machines that are very hard to operate. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC. You got to work for it. WAMC.org.
The thing about the cemetery thing. I mean, all of us had, you know, taken a real licking in our funds, but they came back. So what happened with the cemetery guys?
I think a lot of cemeteries, and this is certainly isn't true with all, but I think what he's referring to is in many larger cemeteries, the money that they had was lost, and they were no longer able to take care of the stones and of the plots that they were promised when people bought these, you know, whether 10 right. years ago or, yeah. or, you know, 70 years ago.
Yeah.
So now you have to bring your own mower and weed whacker and scrub brush to get the moss off
and
the stone.
And look at Detroit. Residents are doing this in the parks, not just in the cemeteries. Yeah, they want their kids to have a place to play.
Well, that's an interesting point, Rosemary. People start co-op, you know, doing stuff.
What they have to.
You know, yeah. right. But I think on cemeteries, people are still dying to get in there, and therefore they
stop him. Stop him! You're in charge of this program,
down.
Joe. Yeah.
Did we see that coming down Central Avenue? I think we did, didn't we? Yeah. we thank you for your letters. Hopefully, we didn't put you off too much, and we love hearing from you. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Let us talk, Jimmy Vielkind, about the Moreland Commission. We spoke about this yesterday, but there were new developments. We spoke about it yesterday, but there were new developments that took place on Tuesday. So bring us up to date.
Well, the big question at the Capitol is what's going to happen next because of this report, which is essentially outlined a lot of things that good government people and people who really follow these issues knew already. It outlined a lot of the ways that money seeps into the political system. It outlined a lot of the potential conflicts of interest. And it included a couple of vignettes, which were really interesting, without naming names, where seemingly perhaps the influence of money in politics crossed into a criminal area. They talked about a legislator who was, working for a company and doing business with this other entity and how the entity was talking about getting state grants because of it. There was another vignette that talked about a storefront medical clinic that was receiving all this money but was not providing any discernible service. So those were some of the things that raised eyebrows, but really it was a litany of things that were already known, perhaps with more damning details than we're used to seeing. So the question is the recommendations of this report were for various things, for changes to the standards for the bribery law, for example, something that literally every district attorney in the state of New York supports. And then there are more controversial aspects.
What are the changes, Jimmy?
Essentially, that they would change the definition for taking a bribe. You wouldn't have to know it was a quid pro quo. Only one party would have to know.
Well, what was the difference? Wait a second. What's the difference between somebody going to a Billy Joel concert and giving $50,000 to the governor for a seat and getting perceived favors back from the real estate, you know, industry point of view, and Joe Bruno selling the horse for, of course, you know, I mean, what are the differences if one party?
Well, arguably, Billy Joel is a better crooner than the horse.
Right,
so that's
right.
The first.
Although you never know.
Right, and there are people who will dispute that.
Absolutely.
But the question, as you point out, Alan, is what is the difference between here's $1,000 in an envelope, I need your vote on this bill, or I'm happy to be here at your fundraiser, Senator Shartok, here's a $1,000 check, let's talk about this bill now that we're here in this closed space. And that's really the problem. So the most controversial of the recommendations of the Moreland Commission was to implement some sort of a publicly supported campaign finance system. This is something that Senate Republicans have been consistently resistant to, and they reiterated their opposition. And the commission itself, which contained Republican appointees. Mind you, these are Republicans who were chosen by Governor Cuomo, a Democrat. It included in the report a dissent about public finance. So Cuomo yesterday, in his first appearance with Billy Joel before the birthday party fundraiser that you alluded to, the governor said, you know, there are a lot of things in this report that are not controversial, and we should maybe focus on moving forward with them rather than getting hung up on those political disputes.
But wasn't he the guy who wanted campaign financing and said so again and again?
He has
and
long
now he's backing
been,
off for
that's
it?
That's the thing. He has long been on the record about it, but there are many, myself included, who would question whether he put his back into it and whether he's ready really to put his back into it now. Yeah. Or whether Cuomo, cognizant of the fact that some of these government reform issues don't always translate perfectly at the polls, would be more willing to come to an arrangement with Senate Republicans, knowing that they have lots of cards in their hand for the other items that he does care about, that he feels voters care about, tax cuts, tax hikes, all kinds of other things.
But wait a second, Jimmy.
And to just let the reform stuff fall by the wayside.
Jimmy, I don't want to hear from the governor's office. Believe me, I don't want to hear this. But you know, there was this big snafu yesterday, and it had to do with whether or not the Moreland Act Commission had looked at the governor and the attorney general and whether their $50,000 for a ticket to a thing had come under investigation. And one of the, what was her name? The wonderful DA from...
I believe you're talking about Onondaga County exec, Joni Mahoney.
Joni Mahoney, the best name in all organized politics.
Right. Joni Mahoney.
Joni Mahoney. And Joni Mahoney said it was never supposed to be about anything but the legislature. Back comes Schneiderman and says, oh no, it was supposed to be about everything. So maybe they took a fall? Do you think they took a fall?
I think that the proof is in the report. And I've read through most of the report, and there are not many instances where they've highlighted questions about the executive branch's fundraising practices. There are not many times where they've seemingly looked at or uncovered any impropriety or potential impropriety in the executive branch. So I think Ms. Mahoney's argument certainly bears weight. And Schneiderman, if you looked at his statement, said that the commission had free rein to do whatever it would. So I think that and this idea is only going to lend ammunition to the critics of this report, which include many legislators, both Republicans and Democrats, who think that this entire operation was a witch hunt and think that it is essentially, as they are arguing in ongoing court cases, coercion to try to get legislators to come around to Cuomo's position on reform issues, including this public campaign finance system.
But Jimmy, when they say come around to his position, there is some question in many people's minds as to whether or not the governor wanted the issue to appear as a reformer or he really wanted things to get done. Now, I happen to think there's something to that when you start backing off on campaign financing in terms of his reaction to this report, or as your colleague Ken Lovett of the Daily News reported, when the governor's office is calling in play saying subpoena this guy, but don't subpoena our friends in the real estate industry. That's pretty bad stuff.
Right. And so I think one of the things to watch going forward here, Alan, I think you've hit it right on the nose, is going to be how committed is Cuomo to this? So yesterday he made those comments where he said we can move forward on the non-controversial stuff. And his administration went into a full walk-back mode, as we reported this morning.
Yes, you did.
Saying essentially that they called the groups and said, no, we're with you. We're with you. We're committed to this. Gubernatorial sources, you know, speaking on the condition of anonymity, called reporters and said, no, we're committed to this. We're absolutely committed to this. And then a formal statement came out that said the governor's comments were misconstrued. So it was a wonderful rear guard action, if I've ever seen one in politics.
But he's getting into a little trouble on this stuff. I mean, one day Chris Christie is reporting, he's reporting that they had a conversation, or it's reported that they had a conversation, and he said he would not support, he would support Christie, and then, or that he wouldn't. Why don't you give us the full story on that?
Right. So what happened there was Chris Christie, the Republican governor of New Jersey and the ascendant head of the Republican Governors Association,
met. One of the presumed presidential hopefuls.
Absolutely. Yep. Was meeting with Westchester County Executive Rob Astorino, who Republican leaders in New York think is probably their best bet to take on Cuomo. And the question was whether Christie told him, hey, Rob, you in? I'm with you. Here's the money. Let's go. Let's get this Cuomo guy. Let's bloody him up, blah, 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 blah. Or whether they discussed their wives, their children, their families running for office, the Mets, the Yankees, the Rangers, and maybe
right.
Billy Joel. Right. So that's been the dispute. And Cuomo said, well, I spoke to Governor Christie and he said it wasn't accurate that he said he was coming after me. It's been sort of a big circling thing in which Christie has come under pressure from the right for maybe not being aggressive enough and going after Cuomo, and in which Cuomo has immediately sought to downplay the idea that the Republicans will be coming after him with the force that were Christie and this national level organization to engage with the gravitas that would bring to the race.
I have a question. As a taxpayer in the state of New York, and I'm watching all of this and listening to all the debates on it, why should I take this seriously? Why is this really anything more than a bunch of politicians making a study and then debating it and nothing changes? Meanwhile, more and more. No, I know everybody. My mother this morning, my bellwether said, what is this? Does this mean anything? What is so answer that. Is this anything different?
Than
politicians trying to cover up for all the arrests we saw in the past year.
I really think that this commission report was supposed to be a shocker. It was supposed to be something that would have gotten your mother to say, good Lord, they need to do something, as opposed to being just another report. I think it may go much closer to being just another report. I think that Cuomo had presented this commission as being able to come up with scalps. That it was a hammer.
Yeah.
But apparently the hammer has dropped, at least initially. Legislators are looking around and seeing that everybody is essentially okay. And now you're right. Back to square one, as one legislative leader just said.
Hey, Jimmy, if in fact this is, you know, really where I'm sort of getting this. If Cuomo really wants this, there are those four legislators, the Democrats, mm-hmm. under Rich Klein from the Bronx.
Jeff Klein,
I'm so sorry. Jeff Klein from the Bronx, who have come up with this alliance with the Republicans.
Right.
But they're Democrats, and they say they're Democrats, and they say they're... are they likely to help the governor get this thing through in the Senate, in which those four would combine with the existing Democrats?
Yeah.
Or are they more likely to stay with the Republicans and chill for them?
Well, so it's sort of an interesting dance that was done on this issue and other issues last year. Because if you're a left-leaning advocate last year, and there were a bunch of them on a bunch of different issues, including public campaign finance, including those abortion law changes, what Cuomo called the Women's Equality Act.
You say
Act.
A bunch of them, you mean of the
left-leaning advocates.
Of the Klein groups. No.
No, I'm talking about left-leaning advocates, traditionally labor unions, Citizen Action, for example. So they're pushing these agenda items. They care about these things. And last year, their ire was directed toward the Independent Democratic Conference. As you say, this renegade clatch of senators that has allied with Republicans and saying, it's you, you're responsible. Get my bill to the floor. And Cuomo was saying, I'm with you. It's them. They're responsible. They need to get the bill to the floor. And so what I wrote this morning was just looking at how did this actually work for them? Because what we saw in this 6-month legislative session this year was we saw that this renegade group cannot, despite whatever its powers are on paper, it has not forced a bill to the floor without the acquiescence of Republican leaders. And I see at this point no reason to think that it will do so again. However, the might of Governor Andrew Mark Cuomo has forced bills to the floor, perhaps against or with the reluctance of the Republican leadership of the Senate. And so it's an open question to me, and it's, again, something that I'll be watching over the next few months as to whether or not these groups will put their target on Cuomo or on the IDC again.
We have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we have other things to talk about. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. We just have a few minutes left and a couple more things to talk about. And one of them is a story that you have up on Capital New York with an A. CapitalNewYork.com, which is which talks about as you believe the headline is the Cuomo de Blasio drama to come. is this one of the things we get to look forward to in 2014?
Oh, absolutely. So I reported this story with my colleague Dana Rubenstein, who and we sort of probed both sides of this, and the story opens with this great anecdote about the Unity press conference. So listeners might remember there was this long, drawn-out primary fight for New York City mayor, and the two top people ended up being de Blasio, now the mayor-elect, and a man named Bill Thompson, who in 2009 was the Democratic candidate. And Thompson came close to what under New York City law would trigger a separate runoff election, but under pressure from all people involved sort of graciously said, hey, you know, I bow out. We're not going to do this runoff. I'm behind de Blasio, et cetera. And Cuomo worked hard to broker that deal. And the story opens about that press conference, about that event on the steps of City Hall in New York City, with top aides to both de Blasio and Cuomo in a shouting match. Who's going to speak longer? Who's going to do what? Who's going to upstage who? Right. And so I think that what we tried to show with this piece is that there will always be tension between the governor of the state of New York and the mayor of the state of New York. As one person I spoke to said, if they say there's no if there will always be tension, and if not, then somebody's lying
and
to you.
In the story, Jimmy, there was that one line in the front page of the Times about this morning about Mrs. de Blasio saying of her husband, of whom she is chief advisor, he has, and I don't remember the exact words, but basically the connotation was he could run for president. Unlimited future. Future of him. Now, that's Andrew standing next to the other guy who has an unlimited future.
Right. And if I can make probably a not profound statement at all, you know, you don't get to be the governor of the state of New York or the mayor of the city of New York without having some ego, you know, without having some chutzpah and some self-aggrandizing tendencies. The fact that you have two people who are very good at it, who, as you say, perhaps have intersecting, overlapping ambition, it's going to inevitably cause tension. And the other interesting wrinkle that Dana and I found was that you have to keep in mind that de Blasio used to work for Cuomo, that in the Hillary campaign, de Blasio was something of a subordinate. And what we heard from a bunch of people is that there's going to be tension along the front, that many Cuomo people kind of still see him that way. And it's going to be weird for him to break out of that mold. You know, for example, Alan, like when you become president of the United States, I'm going to expect you to still take my calls. And I will be offended when you don't.
No, and I will, Jimmy. Yeah, you can be sure of it. But Alphonse D'Amato once said the best thing that has ever been said in all of politics when they asked him he had said one thing and now he was saying something else. He said, that was then, this is now. Now things change.
Right. Well, no, I should note that both men are talking about their long relationship. They're talking about, yes, there'll be inevitable tension, but the fact that we know each other, as Cuomo said, I know when his kids were born. I was with them. I was there. I've known this man for years. We have a foundation of trust. You know, we both like Billy Joel. And so lots of Billy Joel references.
A lot of Billy Joel references. Like, and we didn't even get to the big story about his contract with MSG.
That's right. It's going to be the new Knicks.
But the idea that these men are saying is that this longstanding personal relationship will help them when there is professional tension.
And on the other hand, maybe they really do know each other and maybe it won't help them.
Right.
You know what I mean?
There always going to be some friction between the governor of New York and the city?
Well, you look at Nelson Rockefeller. See, I'm old, but you look at Nelson Rockefeller and John Lindsay. The two guys literally destroyed each other.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm, well, we're out of time, but I thank you all for being with us this morning. We'll do this again tomorrow, and we would love for you to comment today. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Alan, thank you. Rosemary, thank you. And Jimmy, it's Capital New York. That's the rebrand?
That's right. CapitalNewYork.com, recently relaunched. Check it out online.
And congratulations. It's good.
Very, very good. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll talk soon. And the roundtable will continue after this short break.